The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Hi, Pat Choi. Today, Super Sunday, we look at the decisions that shape Sunday's games. Arsene Wenger taking off Oxlade-Chamberlain, Howard Webb not sending off Balotelli, and Mr. and Mrs. Defoe not waiting a few years before getting jiggy so that Jermaine's legs would still have been young enough to reach that ball and blow the title race wide open. That's not all. Liverpool at Bolton have biggest comedy performance with the Trotters since Only Fools and Horses. What now for, inverted commas, King Kenny? We discuss. There's a return of the Bundesliga with some big surprises. There's Lazio failing to interrupt Inter's upward motion. And there's mutiny at Real Madrid. As Sid Lowe speaks. All that and more in today's Football Weekly. That was Happy Chinese New Year at the top, by the way. And it is a Happy Chinese Year of Dragon to you, Raphael Honigstein.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem. Michael Cox also on board today.
Hello.
You get tactics. We've got some big questions to ask you later on.
Looking forward to it.
All right, then. And Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. Are you well?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good weekend?
Yes, grand.
Super. All right. Man City Spurs, Barry.
Yes.
First half, Second half, woof.
Very much so. I think you've pretty much summed the game up in a nutshell there. It exploded into life in the, 55 minutes. And, sorry, before that, if anyone had suggested we'd be in for a five-goal thriller, you'd have been summoning the men in white coats to take them away. But it was a great game. It could have gone either way, and Manchester City probably had the luck that eluded Spurs.
Wow.
And are now very much in the box seat as far as winning the title is concerned.
Well, yeah, unlucky Spurs. When they went 2-0 down, who would have thought they would come back into it? They did with that fantastic Bale goal. There was the Defoe chance, which I referenced before. There was also the fact that, let's be fair, Mario Balotelli shouldn't have been on the field for that penalty.
No, he shouldn't. I mean, I think it was quite clearly a stamp. And it went on to be crucial. I think it's a really huge result, actually. I think it's possibly the biggest result of the season so far in terms of the title race. I mean, we've had some crazy scorelines, some 6-1s and 8-2s, but this, I think, this swing away from Spurs is really, really crucial. And with the psychological impact, knowing that they were inches away from winning it themselves, I think it's a really big win for City.
Mm. You enjoy the game, Rafa?
The second half, yes. First half was very disappointing. Some people said they were cagey because of the tactics, but it didn't look like that to me from City's perspective. They seemed very slow. They seemed like a team who hadn't really started the game at all. I mean, you get this sometimes, especially in lower leagues, that you know teams just don't turn up for one half and kind of take 45 minutes to wake up, and that seemed to be the case because they did find a lot of space, but then the movement was always wrong, the last ball was always wrong. Dzeko had a horrible game, but then second half made up for that. It was absolutely fantastic, and I agree with Michael. I think it was a big result, and I think Spurs can't really convince themselves anymore that they've still got a realistic chance looking at the table. I think it's just a little bit too far now, and I think Alex Ferguson has got it right, saying that he doesn't think that both Manchester clubs will collapse simultaneously. That's why I think it'll be difficult for Spurs.
And how about that Balotelli penalty then?
Well, the penalty itself,
he's a machine.
Good penalty. Very good penalty.
Yeah. I'm not usually a fan of penalties, but he is something.
How could you not be a fan of
penalties? Well, I just find them.
How can you feel strongly about them one way or the other?
I just find them a bit, you know. I don't like them particularly. I like it when the goalie saves.
All right. You know,
but then the rest, I don't like them particularly.
You're a strange man.
Why? Do you like penalties?
Of course.
Right. You're German, points everything.
Good morning.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Football's USP is that it is a fluid game. It is a game in which there is a spontaneity that is direct result of the fact that it is continually in motion. And the fact that this is basically the goal-scoring action boiled down to a man standing virtually on a spot and kicking at a goalkeeper standing in front of him, it just takes all the...
And because it's not unexpected, you know. There's a good chance of a goal.
So yeah, unless, as I say, the goalie saves
it. What would be more appropriate...
I'm not saying it's more appropriate, but in ice hockey, what they do for a penalty is you actually start up the other end of the rink and then you skate towards the goalie. And my grasp of the ice hockey rules is a little bit sketchy, but you only get one shot at it. You can't continually kind of zigzag up and down. As soon as you get past a certain point or turn your back, you've basically had your chance and that's it. It counts as a miss. So that's slightly better. You could get them to do a bit of a run-up. Or you could put a series of obstacles on the way, kind of...
it's a knockout style, maybe a kind of a rope swing you have to get across and a greasy pole. Exactly.
I think the reason you don't like penalties is because when we went to do them in Euro 2008, you were really rubbish at them.
Yeah. Is that video clip still out there?
Oh, yeah.
All right, then. Excellent. Okay, let's move on then anyway to Arsenal Man United. Michael and Raphael, you were both at the Emirates yesterday where Arsene Wenger was getting a bit of a beating from the home fans, and that's continued in the press this morning. Losing to the champions with, what, 10 men out? Is that such a crime?
No, and I don't think the result as such was decisive in starting that mini-revolt in the Emirates. It started way before they conceded the second goal. It started with a substitution of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain for Andrea Shaarvin. Ironically, it's the kind of substitution that perhaps in the past Wenger hasn't done often enough, bringing a more experienced, more expensive player for a youngster who's tiring and who looked tactically suspicious.
Really?
Defensively. I mean, part of the reason why Giroud looked so terrible was because he had absolutely no help whatsoever from Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain.
And that all changed when Arshavin came on.
Exactly, exactly. So I think that the fans, I mean, there's obviously a level of discontent that's been swelling over the last few years, and I think they need something, or this was a case of something sort of to hold on to, where in the minds of a lot of fans this crystallizes the problem that Wenger does something which they ultimately don't understand. And it is difficult to understand why he persists with Arshavin. It is difficult to understand why he persists with not spending players. And, you know, he used the same line in the press conference saying we lacked, in comparison to Man United, we lacked a little bit of maturity and experience. And he's been saying the same thing now for 5-6 years. Every time they get beaten, and they have been beaten 10 out of 13 times by Man United. So at what stage do you start thinking, you know, this is actually a chronic problem here. This needs to be addressed. Mm. He seems to be lost in these three-year plans that never seem to end, like some socialist dictator, and is always promising that good times are just ahead. It's strange, and I think as an Arsenal fan, I'd be very
unhappy. Mm. Michael, as I say, you get tactics. Wenger refuses to explain or justify his decision to bring on Arshavin. Can you?
Well, in his press conference after the game, he was quite defensive. He said he shouldn't have to justify taking off an 18-year-old for the captain of Russia. But it's not particularly relevant that he's the captain of Russia. It's quite surprising he's the captain of Russia. But he's been very poor for a year now, maybe a little bit more. And I think part of the booing from the Arsenal fans is that these are fans that aren't used to new signings. You know, Arsenal don't spend a lot of money. And you know, there's two things with signings. One, it's about improving the team and strengthening in positions you need to strengthen. But it's also about the excitement. I mean, that's why this month every other story will be about the transfer window when there will only be 5 major transfers or something like that. Fans really like new signings. And Oxlade-Chamberlain is young, he's new, exciting. And he just had a shot, you know, a couple of inches past the post and set up a goal. So you can understand why they were, I think, just perplexed that he was getting taken off.
And it wasn't just the fans. The lip readers insist that Robin van Persie was mouthing no.
Yeah. exactly. And there were rumours last night, I think, have been denied, that he'd handed in a transfer request, which is unconfirmed. And I don't think is true.
Was this on Sky Spork News, that rogue Twitter account?
No, it was by a journalist from a rival yet very respected newspaper in this country. But I was watching yesterday and thinking, almost feeling sorry for van Persie, just thinking, you're so much better than the rest of these players. I don't think there's any chance he'll leave now because he won't be able to play in the Champions League. And I don't think he'd want to walk out on Arsenal in the middle of a season. But I wouldn't be surprised if he did move on in the summer, sadly.
All right.
I mean, I agree with what Rafa's saying in as far as Arsene Wenger makes excuses that his team are too young, lacking in experience. But once they become a bit older and gain more experience, they go and play somewhere else. So it's difficult to see how he's going to address the problem or how it can be addressed.
They did have their chances though in this game, didn't they?
I mean, it's like the Spurs City game. It's a game that could have gone either way, but it didn't go Arsenal's. And when your luck's out, it's out, very much so. And Wenger's persistence with Arshavin is just mystifying at this stage because he clearly isn't interested in playing and he's not good enough for Arsenal at the moment. Mm. Not good enough for anyone at the moment.
Here's some worrying numbers for Arsenal. That's three defeats in a row. They have 36 points after 22 Premier League games. That's the worst total at this stage of the season in Arsene Wenger's time with the club. They're as close to the bottom three now as they are to the title. Closer, in fact, if you factor in goal difference. Michael.
And another interesting thing on the subject of three defeats in a row is that they don't recover well from defeats. Two seasons ago, they lost nine times, and I think they were all in pairs. They were in four twos and then another defeat after the last two. Last season, they lost to Birmingham City in the Carling Cup, and from seven wins in nine, they went to two wins in nine or something. So they don't pick themselves up after defeats, and obviously the more that goes on, the more you start to worry.
One thing about United, I think, that should be mentioned is that they were very impressive in terms of their attitude and the resilience and the toughness. I don't think that the midfield is that convincing, especially in the middle. It does look a bit creaky and they were overrun at times. But there were a lot of big performances and a lot of presence from the likes of Evra, and I think Valencia had a fantastic game. And I think even Rooney, even though he didn't have the impact, some of his passing was quite wonderful. So I think they still have that, and I think that's something that will make City think twice, because while this United are not firing and they're not really, as I said, convincing in lots of areas, they do seem to have the mentality of a champion still. They haven't relinquished that, and that ultimately gave them the edge on Sunday.
All right. Now, Arsenal, meantime, have to count themselves lucky that Chelsea were held to a draw at Norwich, because that means they're 5 points off the top four, Arsenal, as opposed to, well, potentially seven. Good result for Norwich, was it?
Well, it was an excellent result for Norwich. I had predicted goals for this game, and all the statistics suggested there would be goals. And
well, especially with Torres on the field, you'd really...
I mean, I'm starting to feel sorry for him now, in so much as you can feel sorry for someone with the... lovely lifestyle he has, but his performance on Saturday was again abject. I think it's 17 games now he's gone without a goal, and while there have been occasional flickers of his class of old, I think even if he clanked one in off his shin now, I don't know if it would open the floodgates or anything.
Grant Holt was asked after the game what Norwich's game plan was, and he said that they wanted to stay very tight and invite crosses from the flanks. And it's interesting, you can do that with Torres, whereas if it was Drogba playing, you probably couldn't. So in that respect, if Torres isn't doing what he is good at, which is kind of getting balls in the channels and sprinting over the top, then Chelsea are, you know, much, much easier to play against.
Right. Interestingly, actually, Kalou and Drogba combined to score the winner for Ivory Coast in the Africa Cup of Nations, which will gladden the hearts of Chelsea fans everywhere.
Indeed. Well, we'll come on to the Cup of Nations a little bit later on, but in a second or two, we're going to be addressing the week's shock scoreline, Bolton-Liverpool. Right then, Bolton-Liverpool 3-1 to Owen Coyle's boys. The kind of result this that got Hodgson fired, a disaster for Liverpool, and it didn't take long to happen either. Just 3 minutes in and Mark Davies opens the scoring, and it was all sort of downhill from there.
Yeah, I was interested to see Gerrard and Adam in the centre midfield. I think
so were Bolton.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Bolton's first two goals were very similar. Mark Davis and Nigel Riococca just strolling through the middle of the pitch with no one tracking them, and I don't think that worked at all for Liverpool.
Liverpool, if they'd kept Ngog, they'd have the same number of league goals and £31 million extra pounds in their pocket. It's quite a thought, isn't it? Erzat's one tweeting and saying, apparently the FA have advised referees to book anyone passing to Andy Carroll for time-wasting.
There were a couple of flashes. I think his combination with Gerrard might be interesting.
Yeah.
Gerrard was playing quite deep, obviously, in that position. And from there, he could kind of cross the ball from quite narrow positions. Carroll had a header early on. It wasn't a great header, but it did hint that maybe Gerrard will be the man to provide crosses if Stuart Downing isn't. I mean, Downing didn't start this game.
But we've seen this in other games before. The home win against Newcastle, when Gerrard came on, he immediately looked like he was going to provide the kind of service Carroll needs, but so far it's not resulted in anything resembling a goal.
No, that's a fair point.
Didn't Carroll provide the assist for Bellamy's goal, and he played the ball through for Bellamy to run onto? I was talking to Greg Ruffley this morning, and he reckons Liverpool's problem is that they don't have a game plan, because when they have Luis Suarez in the team, they don't need one. But he's obviously absent at the moment and will be for another three games, I think. So yeah, that was his sort of assessment of the situation. And it's interesting to see, Kenny Dalglish doesn't appear to be getting much flack. And I appreciate that he's a Liverpool legend arguably their best player of all time, and has a lot of credit in the bank for what he did after Hillsborough and for all he's achieved with the club as a player and manager. But it'll be interesting to see how long it takes for the crowd to maybe get in his back.
Right. Well, this defeat wasn't his fault, though, because he explained that afterwards. It was the players who didn't turn up mentally, and they don't realise what it is to give a Liverpool performance, a kind of Benitez-style public calling out of his squad.
Well, interestingly, I think he's possibly right, but he has to take a certain amount of responsibility because they're his players, and it's his job to motivate them and get them up ready for matches. But he's generally supportive of his players, you know, to the point where some of his comments T-shirts. Go beyond all reason. Yep. So it's quite interesting that he was angered enough by what was a terrible performance to come out and slag them off.
Yeah, well, they have a tough run coming up. They've got the Man City, of course, in the Carling Cup. The semi-finals there. Then they got United in the FA Cup. Wolves away, which is looking like now a difficult game for them. Obviously, Wolves in some trouble at the bottom of the table. Then they're at home to Spurs. And then United, Everton and Arsenal. I mean, they're all tough games at this level, Michael. Yeah, Bolton, though, they're out of the bottom three. Hooray!
Yeah, and they were very impressive.
Good. There you go, Bolton.
Sorry, I was leaving the door open for someone else to have their say.
Some doors I don't want to enter.
Really? How were Bolton able to produce this 3-1 win when they basically barely scored a goal all season?
Well, they really enjoyed so much space, as Michael said. And if it's one thing they do really well, that's run with the ball and have a go. And, you know, you invite that pressure onto you, and they will take their chances. And they couldn't believe it, I think, that they were so open. And it's very strange because, you know, Gerrard has always had this issue that he doesn't really like to come back at all. And we know that Charlie Adam is not a defensive midfielder. So the idea of playing the both of them together was always, I think, asking for a bit of trouble. If you don't have that...
Was it the manager who was being complacent then rather than his players?
I wouldn't say complacent, but I think it was a risk that wasn't... Well, in hindsight, wasn't right. But I think also in theory, I think a lot of Liverpool fans would have looked at that lineup and said, you know, this is actually a little bit open.
One area where Dalglish did take some of the blame before the game was when talking about Stuart Downing. And he said that Downing had found it difficult because he'd been played in so many different positions. And you wonder if he considers that's a problem with Downing, whether Henderson, Rodriguez, Bellamy, Kaut, who have also been shunted around, have found that a bit of a problem. And Gerrard and Adam, although broadly in a central midfield position, are now being asked to play a different role themselves. And, you know, not to want to put too fine a point on the absence of Lucas, but part of his value, in addition to his tackling, is that he's always there, he's always in a position, and you can revolve the rest of the side around him. And to a certain extent, if Carroll was playing well, he's that same kind of central pivot, and you've got some kind of structure and consistency in the side. At the moment, I see the Liverpool team sheet, and I never know how they're going to line up, which can be a good thing, but when they don't seem to get on, when they don't have any kind of understanding, which was apparently the reason why they were bringing in all these players at the same time, so they could play together, to play them in different positions and different formations every week seems a little bit counterproductive.
It's hard to see what their plan is.
Exactly. Well, as Barry was saying, with Suarez, you just give him the ball and he terrorises defences, but without him they look a bit lost.
All right. Well, Bolton moving out of the bottom three then for now. They're just above it, 1 point above Blackburn. So it's QPR on 20 points, then Bolton on 19, then Blackburn on 18, and Wolves on 18 as well, and Wigan on 15. Wolves got beaten in that derby with Aston Villa. Robbie Keane. Hey, Robbie Keane. He's still got it.
Great goals.
Yeah.
And
lovely goals.
And goals for a sixth different Premier League club, which is a joint record with a few other players.
They're going to try and keep him on. They're going to try and negotiate a transfer from the LA Galaxy, apparently. From LA Galaxy, it's not the... Yeah, and good. And QPR...
It is the LA Galaxy.
From the LA Galaxy. Yeah, as I say. Good. QPR, they get a win over Wigan. And well done to them.
And also nice of Hughes to stick the boot into... Warnock saying all the team needed was a bit of structure and a game plan.
Yep. Who said that?
Mark Hughes.
Oh, real? Yeah. Okay, there you go. That was one of the big clashes of the weekend, wasn't it? The Joey Barton, Neil
was
Warnock.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Well, it was supposed to be, but Neil Warnock refused to get involved. And when quizzed about it on Football Focus, he just said that Barton's great trainer, good player, and wouldn't bite, which is most unlike him. But
didn't he say something like he trains well, which rather begs the question of, but yeah.
Well, no, he did also say he was a good player.
Right. But okay.
It would be harsh on Mr. Warnock to try and twist his remark into something along the lines that Barton leaves his best performances on the training field.
All right. All right, we won't do that then. One other game, just quickly to mention, apologies if we skip yours, Fulham-Newcastle, extraordinary match, 4 goals in 16 minutes. Rob Smythe's reporting says, dangerous to draw conclusions from this game because it was as mad as frogs falling from the sky, or words to that effect. But one thing we can say is Clint Dempsey, woof.
He's got it.
Yeah.
He's got it.
Yeah. If we were all managers and we could pick any player, we'd all have Clint Dempsey in our team, wouldn't we? Wouldn't we? I would.
I think he's a good player. I don't quite understand why people think he's so good. I mean, he had a good performance at the weekend and he's been fairly consistent, but I don't think he's
spectacular. I think he looks cool, that's why.
Yeah, pundits always say, oh, Clint Dempsey's, I always like Clint Dempsey. What is it about Clint Dempsey? I think there's that infectious spirit of, you know, basically he's an American as well, which is quite exciting and glamorous. He's a rapper.
Yeah,
like that. And what else we got?
You're not selling him very well. Right. He's an American and a rapper.
Yeah, he's got a cool name, Clint Dempsey.
Yeah, he's got a cool name.
He's just cool. And he scores great goals as well.
Did really we ever get to goals. The bottom of, well, is he a redneck?
Well, I don't think redneck. I mean,
I asked this before and got accused of all manner of...
rightly so.
It was a genuine question. I've heard he is.
That's like him
and
discussing
I want to know
you. Is he a bog trotter?
Well, I am a bog trotter.
Well, that's for you to say. But it's not for him to say, Barry. That's the thing.
But it is for him to say, oh, I'm curious.
Right. So. I don't know. Keep off the grass. Wasn't that his big rap hit that wasn't quite a hit? But anyway. No, he's, anyway, mad skills on that. Good.
What was it about?
It was about respecting the game.
Oh, I thought it was an anti-hashish.
No. It wasn't that. I might have transduced his meaning, but as I recall, it was all about respecting soccer. It's not a sissy
game.
Prison
informers.
Yeah. There you go. Right. Hey, how about Portsmouth? Another winding up order. Michael Appleton will have to sell, says Andre Andronicou, which is a bit of an issue because they've only got 18 players there. Yikes.
Yeah, they owe the Inland Revenue $1.6 million in unpaid PAYE over the last couple of months, which doesn't seem like a huge amount of money. But if you don't have it and the Inland Revenue come knocking, you have to pay them.
That seems to be the case. Reading might have loads of money because they've got this mysterious... And, they're the son of another mysterious Russian billionaire who's just bought 51% of the club. And Swindon, quick word for them. Paolo Di Canio's post-game rant. Did you see this? The 1-0 win. They had a 1-0 win over Macclesfield. You'll recall that Paolo Di Canio has just been suspended for a game for basically coming out of his technical area and all that. So this was his first game back. And guess what? He got suspended. But he says that it's basically racist referees because he's... He was banished midway through the second half after he reacted angrily when a foul on Aidan Flint went unpunished. This is a game against Macclesfield. And he said basically that it's all because he waves his arms and that the fourth official said, no, you can't wave your arms or make gestures. You have to speak. And he said, I'm Italian. This is part of my culture. I don't want to stop the way I am. I want to use my way to call my players over. That's just how I do it. I didn't leave the technical area or use bad words towards the officials. And then he went on this great rant in the press conference. He said, if they want to send me off every game, it's no problem. We're going to win this league anyway because my team is good enough.
Do you think it would have been okay if you just waved an imaginary arm?
That's the third time he's been sent to the stands since he took over at Swindon.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, there you go. Quick post. Oh, Pipov, thanks for reminding me of the worst job I ever have. And I think you'd nailed it there. If you're wondering... Picking out French people from a cafe to answer questions in English live on BBC with spectacularly hilarious consequences. Mr. Vuvuzela says, I'd like to point out that Mr. Wilson is not in Guinea. He's in Equatorial Guinea, which is a classic example of a brutal and corrupt dictatorship. CAF should be ashamed to hand Equatorial Guinea the tournament. Yeah, and they gave the next one, somebody's pointing out today, to Libya before the Gaddafi regime... was toppled. So, yeah, they do have an interesting selection policy there. It's been a great start to the tournament. You had, Equatorial Guinea, actually, they won against Libya. We right-thinking people were rooting for the newly liberated Libyans in that one. Zambia beat, hotly tipped by me, Senegal. Didier Drogba, you mentioned that, victory for Ivory Coast. And Angola got a win with that Minucho screamer. We've got, we'll have Jonathan Wilson, I think, bringing us up to date on Thursday when there's been a little bit more of the opening action to report back on.
The nice people at Equatorial Guinea, the police had the tear gas out before the first game.
Ah.
So, and apparently they had the Equatorial Guinea game was on before the Zambia-Senegal game, so most of the crowd left the stadium at half-time in the double header.
Oh, they only saw one head?
Yes.
That's a bit of a shame. Producer Ben wants to know, as he points out, Burkina Faso called the Stallions and Angola are the Sable Antelopes. That's a top name. Meanwhile, Sudan are the Falcons of Jedi Inn. I know this is the kind of slightly patronising thing people do every time there's a cup of nations. Ooh, these comical nicknames. Why don't European teams have nicknames? I suppose Spain are Las Furias Rojas. Yeah. Italy are the Azzurri, but that's basically saying they're blue. England are what? Are they Three Lions, or is that just a kind of it's a marketing thing, really, isn't it? Mm. What are Germany called?
Bastards.
No, by ye.
What, do they have a name?
No.
Right. Why is that?
We don't do that kind of thing.
All right.
Do German clubs have nicknames?
Yeah, but...
Hollywood FC.
Nothing with animals. No, actually, no, of course they do. Yeah, of course they do.
Okay.
They're the Zebras.
Who's that?
Hemisphere Duisburg, because of their hooped shirts.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Schalke are the Knaves.
The Knaves?
Mm-hmm. Why? Is that a word?
Yeah. Yeah. Why would they be the
K-N-A-V-S.
Knaves?
K-N-A-V-S.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure. I think it's because of the royal blue colour and there's some kind of aristocratic association with the shirt. Mm.
What is a knave?
Well, it's interesting because knave has a negative connotation now, but it's a jack.
In the deck of cards, it's a jack.
But you could also be a knave, a rogue.
Right.
Yeah, a blackguard. Good. Sounds like part three might be a good idea. We'll be back after this. Hey, we mentioned the excitingly monikered teams in the Bundesliga, and up at the top of the German top division, where action has now resumed after the lengthy winter break, how tight is it, Raphael?
I don't want to look for a metaphor here,
okay,
but it's very tight.
It's very tight. 37 points, three teams, and those three teams are who? Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund and Schalke. And how did this happen?
Well, this happened on Friday night. First of all, it started on Friday night with Bayern losing 3-1 away to Borussia Mönchengladbach. It was a bit of a repeat of the first game of the season when Bayern were fairly dominant and then Manuel Neuer mix-up with Boateng, really Manuel Neuer error, gifted Gladbach the goal. And this time it started with Manuel Neuer giving the ball away. Marco Reus scored. Marco Reus, of all people, of course, was the midfielder that Bayern very much wanted to sign. And when he opted to sign for Dortmund in the winter break for next summer, they said, he's not really up for it. And he said he'll give the answer on the pitch, which he duly did.
Have some of that.
Exactly. And if there's one team you don't want to go behind against, it's really Borussia Mönchengladbach, because they're probably the tactically best organised, best adept at playing counter-attacking football team in, certainly in the league, maybe even in Central Europe, under their manager Lucien Favre. And they just took Bayern apart by sitting and hitting them with fantastic counter-attacking goals. The second one was a peach, and the third one was even more beautiful. To Patrick Herrmann goals, who's sort of groomed as the successor of Marco Reus when he'll leave. And that result opened the door for Dortmund, who won 5-1 away to Hamburg. Hugely impressive result and performance on Sunday. And Schalke, who had very little trouble with Stuttgart, 3-1 at home. So those three now level on points. And Gladbach, as you said, just a point behind. So very exciting.
A lot of points and a lot of goals scored this weekend then.
Yes.
All right then. Cool. Does that... are they realistic title candidates, say Schalke and Borussia Mönchengladbach?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Schalke have been flying under the radar, and that's been their main thing. But whenever they came within a whiff of a title, they used to crumble under the pressure. And they're at pains of, again, saying, no, it's nothing to do with us. We're just sort of happy to go along and keep winning our games. I think Dortmund and Bayern really are...
Those are the two teams.
They have a slightly they're on a slightly different level. Gladbach, I think, will run into trouble when other teams play as defensively and as tactically astute as they do. That's what happened to Hertha Berlin a few years ago when Lucien Favre took them almost to a title, and then ultimately teams found that if they sit back and just give the ball to them, there's not much they can do with it. Gladbach are a better side, I think, than Hertha were, but that would, I think, ultimately work against them. As for Schalke, I mean, as long as they can keep Raul going, and he's been, you know, playing really superbly, and they've got now Obasi from Hoffenheim, who's doing a fantastic job on the right, filling in for Jefferson Farfan, they have a very decent squad. The problem is their defence, I think, and Benedikt Höwedes, who's their main central defender, suffered a terrible injury, head injury. It will be out for a few weeks, and they might actually have to go and buy someone because they're not very, very strong at the back. And it was really a weekend of bad injuries as well, with Sebastian Prudel suffering a broken nose, broken jaw bone, and broken eye socket.
How did he get that?
He got kicked in the head.
Right.
It was accidental, but it was a guy exercising or performing a bicycle kick, but right, missing the ball and hitting him instead.
Oh, dear.
Kaiserslautern. And Daniel von Beuten of Bayern broke his metatarsal, so it was really a terrible weekend for centre-backs.
Oh, all right.
Lots of breaks.
Transfer rumours, Dimitar Berbatov, is he heading back to the Bundesliga?
Well, there were rumours yesterday that he'd come to an agreement with Leverkusen for 2012, well, we are 2004, for the summer.
Right.
But nothing official. Certainly nothing happening in January, because no club in the Bundesliga would be stupid enough to pay money for a player who's available free in 4 months' time.
Right, okay. And how good is Papis Dembasise?
He's very good. I think if there ever was a natural number nine suited for the Premier League, I think it's this guy.
Because he's what, big? And
he's big, strong, he's fast, he's very athletic, he's got it all. Not very flashy. I think Demba Ba is the more exciting play. He's got the bit of magic, the trickery. He's very, very straightforward. Most of his goals are headers or penalties or sort of tap-ins, but he loves to play on the shoulder of the last defender. Only Mario Gomez has scored more goals in the last two seasons in the Bundesliga, and this is a guy who doesn't play for a team where you've got Frank Ribéry and Arjen Robben and Thomas Müller behind you, but very mediocre players from Freiburg who are batting against relegation. So I think he's going to be a big success.
How old is he?
26.
Good age. Good age for a striker. Now, excellent. Does sound very, very exciting there. In Italy, meanwhile, Inter continued their winning run. 7 in a row now under Claudio Ranieri. They're up to 4th. Barry Glendinning not even bothering to stifle that yawn. They beat Lazio, who were a place above them. They'd moved past Lazio, who were a bit unfortunate, to be fair. I mean, they had their chances. And Inter were rubbish in the first half. Got an equaliser against the run of play just before half-time with Milito. And then Schneider came on in the second half and completely illuminated them, which is slightly worrying because he's got a terrible injury record, Schneider. And they had been winning without him, but this time there's no way. It didn't really look as though they had any hope of winning without the Dutchman. Anyway,
Claudio Ranieri fuming with that performance.
Yeah, well, I think he was right to be, because it was a really dismal. And not for the first time. They won the derby last week, and the week was filled with this kind of tactical, ideological debate between Arrigo Sacchi on one hand and lots of other people, led by a journalist called Mario Sconcerti on the other, saying, listen, what Ranieri... Well, Arrigo Sacchi's point was, yeah, okay, great, 6 wins in a row, but now could you play some football? It's not enough, you know. You have a responsibility actually to do something on the field, as opposed to sitting there and hitting people on the break. And other people were saying, well, he's basically brought them back from the edge of the relegation zone. Let's worry about the good football later. Results, results, results. But it seems Ranieri is a little bit concerned as well, because, to be fair, Lazio could easily have taken at least a point, if not a win, from that game, because Inter did look very poor. A lot of it, though, was his own decisions. He kind of rejigged the team, strangely enough, for Ranieri. Left-back Nakatomo ended up on the right, kind of advanced midfield wing position you would normally find Maicon putting in crosses. And once he swapped that round and Maicon got forward again, things worked out. But there you go. So they move up to fourth, but they're still 6 points behind Juve, who won at Atalanta. Milan won as well. A couple of great goals from Ibrahimovic. The second one's an astonishingly slick little back heel. And he's now up to 14 this season. They have to hope, Inter, of course, that Juve slip up. Juve are playing Udinese, who are third next week, so it could be interesting. Totti is now up to 211 goals for Roma, which is an all-time Italian record for a single club, beating Gunnar Nordahl's previous figure of 210. And Palermo saved their manager's job with a 5-3 win over Genoa. That's enough of that. Spain. Much to talk about with Sid Lowe. Let's dial him up now.
Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you? Because you had an extra gig, didn't you, yesterday?
Well, sort of, yeah. I had my normal gig was slightly altered from being a part of a programme to being leading the programme, which was a little bit fun.
What programme were you leading, Sid?
It's called Minuto y Resultado, Minute and Result in Spain. I suppose it's similar-ish to Soccer Saturday. And you were
Jeff Stelling?
Without the appearance on Countdown, yeah. So obviously, we do a bit of that where you go around the grounds, find out what's happening, you show the goals from the night before. But normally I go on and give them all the international football side and on set with them for, I don't know, half an hour or something. But one of the presenters was ill, so I was one of the sort of presenters for the whole thing yesterday.
I hate it when presenters bluff their way through programmes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because that happens, I hear. But it's also quite a coup for you, isn't it? That, you know, when they decided we need a host for our Spanish roundup, they went to an Englishman.
Well, I think they probably didn't have anyone else, to be honest.
Well, there's a whole country full of Spanish.
Actually, that's one of the responses that I get quite a lot from Spaniards. Spaniards who don't like me, and of course there are plenty of them.
I can't believe this.
Will quite often say things like, God, has this country really got no one who can speak Spanish properly? Do we have to use an Englishman?
All right. Okay. Listen, what's your take then on the mutiny at Real Madrid? I should say the mutiny at Real Madrid. It all began with that marker cover, Sid. Tell us about that and how that whole training ground interaction came to be on the front page of a leading Madrid-based daily.
Well, that question is the one that Mourinho himself is trying to get to the bottom of, and it's I've been writing about this morning, and I find it impossible not to sort of put on an Hercule Poirot accent and kind of imagine Mourinho, because
he's
got the players together. No, he got the players together in the hotel and basically said, you know, this does us damage. It's a gilipollez, which is a really difficult word to translate. I think the best translation is an act of daft twattery. It's a gilipollez and to do this now, and I will find out who's responsible for filtering this. And he got the team together, and I couldn't help but have this image of Poirot walking around an English man house and go, one of you in your room is the medal.
Today,
maybe Philippe should do this for us.
What actually was on the cover of Marca then?
Right, okay, so Mourinho's question is one that you've asked me. How did this get on the cover? What is on the cover is a discussion between Mourinho and Sergio Ramos. And there's tension in the dressing room of Real Madrid, although actually what they've said about this is it happened on the pitch during training, in which Mourinho turns to Ramos and says, you have killed me in the mix zone. Now, the context here is that after the Barcelona game on Wednesday night, and I actually must admit at the time I thought it was a very, very telling comment from Ramos. Ramos was asked about Real Madrid's approach, which of course, as everybody I think now knows, was very, very defensive. They had one shot on target in the entire game. I thought they were desperately, desperately poor. And if, you know, if you laud someone tactically, then also you have to criticize them tactically when it doesn't work. And Ramos was asked about this post-game, and he said, we limit ourselves. All we do is follow what the coach tells us to do. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. Now, that's given the context of Real Madrid, a club where players basically don't do interviews anymore, increasingly are cut off from media, are not allowed to talk, in which there's a real sense of suspicion around some of the footballers, in particular some of the Spanish ones. The context of that is that that's quite a strong quote within that context. And Mourinho clearly thought so, and I think that, again, reinforces that it's a strong thing to say, because he said that to Ramos, you killed me in the mix zone, to which Ramos replies, no, boss, you've only read what was in the paper, not everything we said. To which Mourinho replies, given that you Spaniards have won the World Cup and you're protected by your friends in the media, and then there's a pause, and he says, and given that the goalkeeper, and Casillas is 20, 30 metres away, apparently training with a goalkeeping coach, and hears this, which suggests, of course, by the way, that they must have been a certain degree of shouting for Casillas to hear this. Casillas shouts across, Mister, round here you say things to our faces. There's another bit of the conversation later on where Mourinho says, Sergio, where were you on the first goal? To which Ramos says, marking PK. You should have been marking Puyol. Yes, but they were doing screens on us and we decided to change the markings. To which Mourinho says, oh, I see. So now you're the coach, are you? Ramos says, no, but given the situation in some games, sometimes you have to swap the markings over. Then again, seeing as you never played, you wouldn't know that.
Ka-ching!
Yeah, there's a couple of other little bits. For example, there's the criticism of Mourinho for attacking Iker Casillas for seeking a peace with Xavi from Barcelona and saying, because he asked for, you know, he asked for forgiveness, he said he was sorry for everything that happened, exactly as Mourinho had done with Pepe a couple of days before. So this is a conversation which, by the way, it's worth pointing out, extremely polite, despite the things they're saying. There's no, you know, you're an F, you're a this, you're a that. It's also very, very detailed, the way that Mark put this out. And right now, Mourinho is trying to answer that question you asked, how did it get there?
All right. In the meantime, the game against Athletic Bilbao on Sunday night saw whistles when some parts of the Bernabeu crowd were doing their usual Mourinho chants. Is that right?
Yes, a caveat, James. Oh. Here's a caveat for you. I don't think it's a case of the rest of the stadium whistling or booing Mourinho as such. I think it's a case of them saying, don't defend him now, not you lot, not after everything that's happened. This isn't the time to laud him, because, of course, the way they see it is the Ultrasur, who, frankly, a bunch of head cases, defending him at exactly the wrong time. So I think it was a whistle for Mourinho, but I think it was a whistle for Mourinho in a specific context and given who was defending him.
All right, well, a 4-1 result against Bilbao will certainly have improved the mood there, but no doubt that Mourinho beginning to see some former friends turning on him. Meantime, Barcelona, another hat-trick for that man, Messi, in their game at Malaga. That's 9 hat-tricks he's had since the start last season. Cristiano Ronaldo's had 12.
Yeah, it's madness, isn't it?
Mad.
And it was an absolutely brilliant hat-trick as well. It was the first was a fantastic header. Those people, there's always this big obsession with trying to find something wrong with Messi's game. Oh, he's a short arse, he can't header. It was an absolutely brilliant header, the first one. 2 wonderful goals as well, dribbling through and finishing off. Should have scored a 4th, to be honest. He was sensational yesterday.
Brilliant, Sid. All right, nice one. What you got midweek? Is it Copa del Rey again?
Copa del Rey semi-final. And one of the things I think, James, everyone's forgotten about this whole Copa del Rey business is there's still a second leg to come.
Yeah, all right. We look forward to your review of that on Thursday. I'm sure there'll be plenty to talk about.
I'm sure there will be.
Nice one. Thanks, Sid. Well, that's Sid Lowe in Spain. Of course, we've got cup action coming up as well. That Man City-Liverpool game. Michael, is City going to turn Liverpool over? 1-0 lead?
I think it's quite finely balanced, actually. Liverpool going back to Anfield with a second leg and a 1-0 up, I think they're always in a good position.
What about Palace defending that 1-0 lead away to Cardiff?
The first game is dire, so hopefully the second will be more lively in Cardiff. Cardiff won at the weekend. They beat Portsmouth 3-2,
yep. Mm-hmm.
And Palace lost against Blackpool.
They certainly did. Well, there you go. That's coming up midweek. All sorts of other stuff too. We'll be back on Thursday with that preview of the FA Cup action. And next weekend, a review of Africa Cup of Nations Week 1 and other stuff too. But in the meantime, many thanks to Raphael Honigstein, to Michael Cox, and to Barry Glendenning, who've come today in matching purple jumpers. I mention this because sneaky Raphael took a picture. He was quite excited by this kind of Jurgen Love Hansi Flick tribute act. So he's taking a picture, which I think producer Ben is going to post up there on Twitter and probably link to.
The fact that Michael and I are dressed identically,
yeah.
If we were women, we'd be very embarrassed. But
right.
Because we're men, it's just, you know, I'm sort of thinking, yeah, I knew it was fashionable.
Yeah, there you go.
And he's proved it.
All right. They're wearing identical V-neck purple jumpers. Raphael has gone for a round neck, almost sweatshirty bit of knitwear. It's grey.
And you're wearing a brown shirt, which listeners will be able to see in all its glory on...
Listeners in the south, southwest and west regions of the BBC will be able to see later on Monday night, or later still on the iPlayer. Okay, then. Very good.
Do you ring Graham Murty or Leroy Senior to make sure that
every
they're
morning.
Not wearing brown shirts?
No, I know what they'll be wearing. Right. Yeah. I mean, Graham will be wearing a blue... Kind of.
I think the only one you have to worry about wearing brown shirts regularly is Paolo Di Canio.
And on that note, we conclude today's pod. Have a super week. Speak to you Thursday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.